Hey, everybody. Sorry I'm a little late. I just finished doing a little phone banking shift online from my computer at home, talking to voters in Georgia who had asked for mail-in ballots but had not gotten them yet, just helping them troubleshoot that process. It was with a Georgia-based voting rights group called Vote Riders. Everybody was so thankful for help, especially the voters themselves. And it just reminded me that I realize a lot of folks don't necessarily know what doing election volunteering looks like when you're doing it online. There's text banking, there's also phone banking, and the kind of volunteering that folks are doing at this point, they're not like sending people out to go get yelled at by jerks. They're having folks go and talk to supporters and help them make sure that they know where to go to vote, they know the hours, they know how to get their vote counted. They're helping to track down missing information and stop voter suppression. They're not sending us out to have an argument. To be clear, that's actually not what they have folks do at any other time either, really. But right now, it's especially all about just getting people to that last step of having their votes sent in and counted. So it's really the easiest, friendliest time to volunteer on the election is the next several days. I only spent 2 hours. That's all I needed to do today. And it is so much better feeling to have done that than to be just doom scrolling on my phone. There's late night stuff you can do with Alaska. You can text bank if you don't want to talk to anybody at all, which I totally understand, especially after a long day of work. Keyboards for Kamala is one of my friend's projects for folks who are just 100% going to just be digital. I'll put that link in here as well. I love to play matchmaker between listeners and volunteer opportunities. So I'm going to have a lot of those listed on my social media. That's LEVIN over on Blue Sky and on the other place, Twitter. I am still ELANA underscore Brooklyn. I'll just go over there to share volunteer opportunities with people. I know not everyone can do everything, but you will feel so much better. And I say this with love and with the truth of my experience. We really are all counting on each other. We need each other. And, if you're listening to this after the election, there's still going to be more volunteer work to do. We're going to have to work to make sure that every vote is counted. And there's all the ongoing struggles and policy fights that we're going to continue to have, right? It doesn't end here. I really encourage everybody to do something, not to get all Stan's soapbox about things. Nobody likes the rejection. Nobody likes talking to strangers. But everyone feels better having helped other people. And this is how we're going to survive. And every little piece is necessary for us to win. And with that, I send you on a brief escapist detour. Welcome to Graphic Policy Radio. This is your host, Ilana Levin, and this is a podcast about a comic book show, I suppose. Joining me today is a returning guest, the wonderful Leslie Lee, and he is the host of Struggle Sessions, which is a culture podcast that you cannot afford to miss. Writer and host of Struggle Sessions. And we've talked about many comics and comics adjacent thing, you and I, over the years. And
You're my favorite person to talk comics with by far.
oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. That means a lot to me. And I'll say, when I began watching the show that we're about to talk to tonight, I said to myself, I really hope Leslie's watching this because I really want to talk about the show as Leslie. Then I emailed you and you had been. I'm like, yes. So the show we're talking about today is Batman, the Caped Crusader, which is a new animated series on Amazon, of all places, despite it being a Batman cartoon, with Paul Dini and so many comics writers that we know and love, like Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka, Mark Bernardin, just like a whole, what's the word I'm looking for? A killer's row. I don't know.
Killer's Row, yes.
Yes, a killer's
A
row.
rogues gallery,
A
if you
rogues
will.
gallery of really good DC crime, gritty, Gotham-y kinds of writers. And I've always been a fan of Batman animation series, although there are so many, I have not actually watched them all. But I had been doing a rewatch of Batman the Animated Series, in fact, when we then saw that this show was coming. And it was just like, I don't know. I felt at first that, like, why are we going to do a Batman show without Kevin Conroy? But I gave it a shot, and I was just immediately drawn in by the wonderful, like, 40s noir aesthetic of the series and the quality of the visual storytelling of this series is really top-notch. It is the best-looking Batman show since the early seasons of BTOS. I think that's not even a debatable question. What brought you to the series? And, you know, do you feel like folks should check it out?
So I there's maybe some discord because we usually are in sync with our tastes. Mm-hmm. But I did have a different take on it. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the early episodes, especially the early episodes, I was actually surprised by how much I was not into them. Because Ed Brubaker, Greg Rucker, two of my favorite comic book writers, I've read dozens and dozens of things written by them. I loved Batman the Animated Series. I loved that show so much as a kid. This show took so long to make. There was a bunch of rigmarole. You mentioned that it's on Amazon. It started off as a Max show, and then there was reports that ended up getting canceled, but it wasn't actually canceled. They were just going to shop it somewhere else. I don't know what happened with the first, say, 6 or 7 episodes, but the last few are pretty good. And I really felt like delivered on the visuals of it. And actually, for the first 7 or 8 episodes, it's like it's an animated series, but there's not a ton of animation, especially when you compare it to the original Batman the Animated Series. You don't see those, you know, bizarre cartoonish facial expressions, like when Harvey Dent is having his pre-Two-Face moment and he's sweating, and there's so much characterization and storytelling in the visuals that you get in the later episodes of the series, but not in the early ones. I feel like there just was not a lot of budget for the first one. But when it get towards, when, by the time it got towards the end, though, it started to feel like you started to get the feel old feeling back. And so I feel like as the show progressed, it got better, and they've already announced that there's going to be a season 2. So I'm excited for a season 2. But I would actually, you know, I asked people on Twitter what they thought of the show, and most people were like, most of my followers were like, they weren't into it. They watched 1 or 2 episodes, then fell off. But I would recommend maybe people start with the later episodes, maybe even like the last 3 or 4, but like Harley Quinn shows, that might be okay. But some of the early episodes, it didn't really lock me in. We can talk about it episode by episode. By the end, though, I was pretty much on board. And I think the next season will be very, very interesting. Could be very good.
Well, I think that's good advice then for folks who have checked out the show and were like, maybe come back for the last row of 3 episodes and see if that gets you or not. I mean, I will say for me, there's always about like a little bit of time where I hear a Batman and it's not Kevin Conroy and it bothers me. But I was able to get on board with this performance much more quickly than the others I've seen. And I think it's partially because it is a very different take on the voice, but also feels very plausible. So you're not like getting the sense that this is somebody doing a bad Kevin like impression or anything.
He's Hamish Linklater. He does a great job with the voice.
Yeah. And that was helpful. And then I'm just a sucker for a show that has a visual direction to it. And this is so Art Deco and so noir in the styles that it's drawing from that, like, that'll just carry a long way. Like, I hate the look of contemporary adult animation these days. There is so much just ugly, cartoony look. And I think cartoons are beautiful. If you're Alex Toth, or if you're anything that Genndy Tartakovsky is doing, like, I love that cartoony. But I'm talking about, like, the ugly, I mean, like, Lower Decks.
Rick and Morty.
Lower Decks is a great show, but I'm not a big fan of the animation. Like, just like a lot of, this show has a look and style that's like, it was making a choice. And that's enough to bring me in. And then the way it's developed some characters, like we have a Harley Quinn, and this part of the show is going to be spoiler free, folks. We're going to go full spoilers in a little bit, but we're spoiler free for a bit. I will say the direction they're taking for Harley here as a character who is not connected to Joker, has her own motivations. Like, I really liked that reimagining. And in general, I thought the reimaginings that were proposed here were felt justified and creative in a way that sort of just treating it as being like an interesting alternate universe version of what we know and love. Like that was interesting in to me enough in and of itself.
See, some of the reimaginings, all of the major ones, I felt like they made all of the characters were still interesting. I liked the Harley Quinn character a lot, but that could have been a character in addition to Harley Quinn. I felt like they were some of the changes made the characters so fundamentally different that they were still interesting characters. These are still characters created by Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka,
right. But
like some of them were so different, it was like you could have just made a new character and called them this and still had the original character there, like Barbara Gordon.
Yeah,
I think is probably the biggest example because like she's there. They need an ADA character because this is kind of like a cop procedural sort of thing, and so they make Barbara the defense attorney. And her character is fine, it works for the show, but it's like you also could, that just could have been another character, and you also could have had Barbara Gordon, college student Batgirl, in it as well.
I think in some ways though this version fits in with his world better. Like I mean, one of the things that is cool about the original invention of Barbara, of having Barbara Gordon become Oracle, was back in the day where this was happening, somebody being an information data broker, like Computer Whiz, and having that be something that a librarian had been, made a lot of sense because most people were not using computers, but librarians were. And most people did not know how to use computers to find information, but librarians did. And that whole combination, Sked of Sills, was like really, was able to have this female character who had previously been kind of like a backup bonus girl, weaker girl version of something, was able to like make her into a unique and valued character. But then in this world where there aren't computers and like what utility does the college student girl, like I don't see her as having as much utility to Batman to stand on her own the way like the badass defense attorney. I mean, and you can tell her dad has been taking her to the shooting range. Let's just put it that way from the series. She's a badass of a mental and a physical caliber. You know what? I think she fits with Batman's world and needs better than the original character did within this time period and series.
Okay, but I see what you're saying. It's like I feel like the Harley Quinn character. I like that character. That's like an interesting villain they created. Mm-hmm. But like she could have had like her own kind of name and it could have been an original villain, and you could still have, you know, the Harley Quinn who's not a sadistic serial killer in another episode. But it's not like these characters are bad, or like Renee Montoya too. It's like they really changed her personality.
Yes.
She's more of like a senior detective now,
she feels very young on this show, and like she feels like she's just new. There's a lot of like Batman Year One-ness to it, so I wasn't surprised that had of like a Renee that doesn't seem as jaded and like burnt out as like the Renee that we kind of know from the comics. So I don't know, that felt like, because the whole thing feels like this is all very early in Bruce's career. Like you can tell there's so many things that he has not worked out yet, and when the series begins, most people don't even think he's real, so it's very early.
Yes.
So I don't know, that part worked for me, but like, I guess just specifically with Harley, I don't need more of the Harley that was established, and I'm like tired of the character constantly having to be tied to the Joker, and I like the idea of just removing her from that, and I enjoyed her relationships with the other characters. I will say maybe it's time to switch to this spoiler-filled mode of the show now. I guess I'll just end this spoiler-free part with saying that there is, it's a relatively short season, 10 episodes. I am really eager, and I really enjoyed my rewatch. I really did. And there are a number of reveals through the season that I knew I wanted to rewatch the series because I was wondering how I'd feel seeing them in a different light. And I feel like a lot of that did pay off for me when I rewatched it, which I just finished redoing before you and I hopped on here.
Yeah, it tries, it has a bit of a serial feel. I actually wish there was a little bit more of it. I would have liked to see some of the stories that were in one episode stretched out over multiple episodes, more of like a Deep Space Nine sort of pace, and where you have the B plot not get quite resolved and then move on to the next. They did a little bit of that towards the later season, towards the later episodes, which again brings me back to my point. I think season two could be very, very good because it seemed like they kind of got into their groove towards the end.
There's also a lot of really good homages to classic cinema scenes happening throughout. Like there's the staircase scene from Robin Hood, the Errol Flynn movie. Like there's a really great fencing scene that's definitely calling that to mind in one of the early episodes, I'll add. You get a lot of like stuff from like In a Lonely Place and Double Indemnity. Just like there's just so much good noir shit in there. It's a cinematography hide and seek. If you're going to have characters having a sword fight and they're on a TV or film set, you might as well have them go for the Robin Hood, you know, fencing scene. So, you know, but yeah, so let's go full on to spoiler mode for folks and roll from there. You know, one of the things I wanted to get your take on is, I really think that this might be the most corrupt Gotham Police Department of any Batman media, other than maybe Gotham Central, where straight up like one cop murders another. There's like, because like straight up cops trying to murder others, cops are just killing people left and right.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very, very corrupt. And it's kind of strange because it's like, Flash and Bullock. Flash and Bullock. And Bullock, who is usually portrayed as like, you know, an oaf, but not like explicitly murderous, is explicitly murderous.
Yeah.
In this one, like fully corrupt. And then Jim Gordon, and this is, I did kind of have an issue with this because they made Jim Gordon black and like somewhat Southern, but he ended up being like very passive. It's like he knows Flash and Bullock are like murdering people, and it's like seven episodes later they're still like in the department leading the squad or whatever. So, but it is a very corrupt organization, and Batman spends a lot of time fighting the cops more so than helping them. As maybe it's 50-50.
I mean, he spends, the only cops who he helps are Gordon, like everybody else is, and Renee Montoya, like everybody else is getting their asses beat, sometimes theatrically, and like deserving it. I mean, I was really enjoying how clearly at odds with the cops they are. I mean, the whole sequence where the cops let Firebug out and bait him to set fire in a poor neighborhood to try to draw Batman out to arrest Batman, that's like kind of the worst thing that Gotham Police have ever done. So like, they're literally endangering the lives of hundreds of people and making hundreds of people homeless to try to draw Batman out because they're incapable of doing their jobs like the quote unquote right way. And I just think that's like one of the worst things the Gotham Police have ever done. And I am proud of this show for going there.
And then when the plan doesn't work, they shoot Firefly's ass and he falls out the window. Like that was wild to see. Bullock, I did not think he had it in him.
Well, I love that the headline from the paper is like hero cop stops Firebug. Like it's very, the show can be very dark and cynical in ways that feel appreciated. But there also are moments where like, what do you think about all the debates between, and this was sort of mid-season, between Babs and her father about like second chances and who deserves second chances and if people's circumstances should impact how, you know, how they're seen by the court. Like they have you can tell that this is people that they've been debating this with each other, you know, for a very long time now. And that we're only kind of getting a small peek into that kind of debate between those characters, you know, father and daughter that are, definitely having with each other. And I thought it was interesting because at the end of the episode where they really have the most severe sort of difference of opinion on the right way to pursue justice, I think it kind of leaves with him being right and her agreeing with him reluctantly. But I'm not sure if that's how everyone would read that scene. This is the episode where there's the assassination attempt on her, and her and her dad are like squabbling the whole time. And she's saying that people need to take into consideration the like lives and context that, you know, that the people who are on trial have gone through. And so she's saying actions aren't the only thing to consider. And Commissioner Gordon said actions are the only thing. And then yes, there's this great moment where she says cops are allowed to make mistakes, but citizens can't, which was like, oh, got it. She's saying like, well, the reason he got off is because the cops did this, that, or the other. And he's justifying the cops making mistakes. And it's sort of like how people talk about how we have to move slowly and not move too fast, lest we scare the cops who might feel compelled to have to shoot at us. Like, you know, people have to be on constant awareness, lest we not disturb the cops so they don't hurt us. You know, it felt like it was the show taking an angle on that. And I liked that. But then by the end of the episode, somebody has tried to kill her and she's sort of agreeing with her dad, I think, a little bit, which made me a little sad.
Yeah, they tried. I've read a lot. I've read Gotham Central, mm-hmm. right? Which Ed Brubaker and Grant Rucka, I think, co-wrote the first few issues. And I've read a lot of Grant Rucka's work. He's not, you know, I don't think they're abolitionists, no. I would say.
It's hard to be that and do a Batman book also, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, I mean, they spend a lot of time writing about criminals as humans. They also write about a lot of cops as humans and heroes and hero cops. And this was a big thing during their runs on the Batman comic because you don't always have to make Batman cop-centered necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you don't have to, but that was their kind of thing. They were very much like a David Simon.
Yes.
A lot of people compared Gotham Central to Homicide, Life mm-hmm. on the Street, but with supervillains, which I think is fairly apt. So I think they do have that sort of mindset. Now, I think this show is a vast improvement over how they might have, even though, you know what, I kind of take it back because when you look it back and watch Batman, the animated series, the original one, like half the episodes are about Batman feeling empathy mm-hmm. for like the villains by the end. And that's kind of the heart of the show, actually. And the creators have talked about this. Like, they didn't want the show to just be Batman being up,
getting
you know,
up the criminally
people
insane.
Going through.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. They wanted, you know, to show the other side. And that gives the show the heart that it has. Mm-hmm. I think this show at times, like you said, it's very cynical in a lot of ways. And it kind of leans into this, you know, I mean, it talks about the gray areas, but I don't know if they quite show it as much as Batman the Animated Series did. If you know what I'm saying. Like they talk about it more and more explicitly, but it's not as built into, I feel, the storytelling as it was in the original.
Well, yeah, one thing I do think is really interesting though is the way they really show Harvey Dent as being a dark mirror to Bruce. And they have a lot of characters actually operate as dark mirrors to Bruce in the series, but especially Harvey Dent. Like, you know, when Harvey Dent begins his crime fighting spree, like that's a different way of for Bruce to have gone, you know, with his own response to crime. You know, and when you have Bruce sort of consider the gun and a sight against the gun, you know, and earlier in the series, Selina, in fact, is like a dark mirror to Bruce. And I like her doing that as opposed to just being his love interest. Like, she's the other celeb debutante who's had a traumatic thing happen to them in their youth. And he's one way to handle it, and she's a different one. Like, and they really do show like the parallels between her and him. And I appreciate the show being willing to not just have female characters operate as potential love interests. I thought that was cool. And I don't think I've ever seen media show Selina as like a alternate possibility for Bruce to have been. Because so much media assumes that men and women are so different that you could not possibly have them have similar perspectives, like existences or anything like that. It's like, no. So I thought that was cool. I mean, I should ask you in general, like, what did you think about this version of Catwoman?
I have to say, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. This is the least horny that Batman has ever been.
Oh, overall, yeah.
In this world, in this time, when Batman looks at Catwoman like she's a bug, and his entire plot for the episode is to entrap her into stealing the pearls his mother was wearing when she was murdered. Now, that's pretty fucked up psychologically, but it's not quite as fun as the first episode of Batman the Animated Series, which was a show for children. But like the very first line that Batman utters is, in the entire series is, the new cat burglar is a woman. And he's like immediately, like we know a little bit about Batman, like immediately, like, yes, he's fighting his crime, but also he's intrigued by this other person who's wearing this costume. And when you see Selina Kyle, the first thing she's doing is bidding to buy Bruce Wayne. And we know that like one's a criminal and one's a vigilante. And like, we're immediately interested in this really hot robots, and it's like kids show, you know. Watching that after watching this, even though like, yes, it's interesting to use Catwoman as a dark parallel, it's not nearly as fun to watch in a lot of ways. Like, you don't have the flirting between them. They kind of just like he really just seems like disgusted by her, and then she's one episode and done.
Yeah.
And so like again that could have been a character, that could have been a character that was not Catwoman. You could still have Catwoman. Or I just wish there was a little bit more work put into their relationship, and they're having some sort of relationship. It doesn't necessarily have to be sexual. It could have just been even a friendship. I would like to see them hanging out at the tennis club or something, running into each other in social circles more. Just anything that would make them like connect a little bit more as a character, because then I would learn a little bit more about Bruce.
But that's the thing. This Batman is very, very early in his career, and he is so emotionally fucked up and just isolated, and he doesn't have any friends, and he treats Alfred like an employee. He treats Alfred like trash. He has no friends.
He's isolated. Mean to Alfred. I did not
that
like
that. Breaks
him
my heart.
So,
yeah. I have a whole bullet. We have to talk about the Alfred thing in a little bit. It's like a huge issue. But I think that does point to the thing which I'm saying here, is that this Batman, this Bruce, is not interested in dating because he's not interested in other people. He's hardly a person. He's only interested in stopping quote unquote crime. So I'm not surprised that this Batman is not interested in having a flirtation with her or anyone else, because he's so repressed. He's just a fully repressed Batman still. And I think that, you know, the way the season ends sort of implies where he's realizing he does need friends, he does need community, and that, you know, maybe this is a Batman who in the future can see some interest. But like, this Bruce wouldn't even be interested in like traditional Selina, who's awesome, let alone current Selina, who's like terrible, but is, I think, terrible in an interesting and very believable ways.
She's kind of like Anna Delvey, I feel like.
Who's that?
Anna Delvey. She's like the woman who faked being an heiress or something like that. She scammed a bunch of people in New York.
And, you know, so it's like, I'm not surprised that all he wants to do is arrest her, because she just is a walking version of what he thinks other people think he is. And, but you're right. Like, it means we're not getting the playfulness and the sexiness that we got in the original series. Like, no question. You're correct. That is not a thing in this show. But I just can't imagine this Bruce, like, does this Bruce even have sex? Like, he's just not there, you know?
Yeah, and I'm fine with that. But I really do wish there was more of this Bruce. Like, let me see how dark he is. Like, there is that one scene where he kind of turns on Harvey, I think maybe in the last in the very last episode, I think, actually, when he's talking to Harvey when he's in jail, where he's kind of like when he breaks character a little bit into mm-hmm. Batman. I would like mm-hmm. to see a bit more of that over, like, more of Bruce's life. What does he do and how does he hide this anger? That could have been something that we saw a little bit more of.
Well, then let's definitely talk about Alfred now. Because, yeah, Alfred, he's so terrible to Alfred this whole series. And, like, the real Bruce character arc of the season is, like, to get Bruce to start calling Alfred by his first name and treating him more like an ally. And what's crazy is, like, when we see that he's been living alone with this man who he treats as, like, an employee since he was a child.
Yes.
That's insane.
It's pretty fucked up. It's pretty fucked up when you think about it, because you don't even really believe it when you first start seeing it. It's like, why is he being so mean to Alfred? And then at some point, Lucius Fox tells him, you know, you are supposed to treat the help like people. And I was like, who is the help here? What are you talking about? What help? Alfred's his, like, dad, but
I know. I'm like, what? Yeah, exactly. I was like, the hell? Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. Like, Alfred is his dad. What are you? Oh, God. But you're right. He's not here. That's terrible. And it becomes more terrible when you're like, but wait, there's, like, nobody else. Like, there's, like, no one else in his life. So, yes, he's, like, terrible. And he's, like, raised himself. And that's terrible.
And I think that's where the show kind of misses the opportunity to do what the original series does, is show more of these, you know, strange, surreal dream sequences about Bruce's psyche, which we see. And I imagine this Bruce's would be very interesting and very dark and very, like, I want to know more about this. This might be the worst bat. This is actually, I think when you look at it, this is, like, the worst, most isolated Batman that we've seen, like, ever. Yeah. Like, this is, they're like, even more than, like, Dark Knight Returns Batman. Like, Dark Knight Returns Batman is, like, you know, like, the coolest, a really cool dude compared to this guy. So I would have liked to see what that means to him having to live his life as Bruce Wayne a little bit more, and how that would negatively impact him. Because if he is, and the show proposes this and we see it a lot, if he's no different than the villains in a lot of ways, then he shouldn't be able to keep the Batman and the Bruce separate so easily because none of the villains do.
Yeah, that's a really good point. But yeah, I really think that this is, like, a really raw Bruce who just hasn't figured any of his shit out yet. I love Alfred trying to get him to go to therapy.
Yes.
As we all know, men would rather commit random acts of violence on strangers than go to therapy. So,
but here's God the bless thing. Here's the thing. It turns out the therapist was a villain who was probably going to, like, brainwash him at a certain point.
Yep. Absolutely. I loved... let's fully talk about Harley. I loved how she switched, like, the actress switching her voices. I enjoyed them both thoroughly.
Yeah, Jamie Chung is the actress who plays her.
She's so good.
Yeah, she's done a lot. She was in Lovecraft Country. She was really good in that, too.
Mm-hmm. I really love the way she turns on the charm and, like, switches it off and goes full threatening gravitas. Just a wonderful performance. And I loved when she showed up when they bring her into the police to, like, help profile the Batman. And she really fucking nails it, is the thing, right? She's really fucking good.
Yes, she's very good. I like that character a lot. I see why the show needs that character and why we use that character. I would like to see a little bit more of that character early on. That's one of the storylines that I wish was a little bit more serialized. Like, tell us in the first episode that, hey, these rich guys are giving away all their money and then mysteriously turning up dead. That could have been a thing dropped in each episode leading up to it. But from the moment of the reveal that she's doing that to when everyone figures it out is like 5 minutes of screen time. Like, Batman knows, Barbara knows. Like, it actually happens a couple of times. Like, the first witness says who the killer is, like, twice, two or three times in this show, where it's just kind of a strange choice for people who I know how to write, like, mysteries, you know, like Ed Brubaker and Grant Rucker know how to write mysteries. So it was it's weird that they took a few shortcuts, and it's actually not as procedural as you might think, or at least the procedure is very straightforward.
You know, What I'm wondering is if maybe this is really like, because this is all them thinking it's going to get canceled at any minute. And if they don't get it in there, it's just not going to have, it's not going to happen. Mm. You know, I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. Because you're right. Like, these guys know how to do that. I really feel like, I just love like Harley saying, like, you know, your repressed trauma is something you might not even know you're dealing with. And it's like, yes, like she so fully has his number. It's great.
Yeah, I like it. And I liked her little dungeon. Now, it was Poison Ivy-esque when you kind of looked at it, you know, like, yeah, she's brainwashing men, taking their money and punishing them for their crimes. But I liked it. I liked it. I thought that was like a really, you know, pretty good, very good episode. I liked that Harley. I liked the switch up. I like her costume. And it also like her having that romance, that brief romance with Renee, that felt like, okay, that's kind of one of the B plots that gave a lot of flavor to the original series. So it felt like the show was kind of getting into the swing of things.
I really like enjoyed those characters' chemistry with each other a lot. And I love that. I mean, she's going to be back, right? Like, she didn't die. She falls off and then she lives. She makes a phone call.
Yeah.
So we'll be getting her again. I think that there's a lot of characters who will be coming back and some others that won't, but she will be back. What did you think of the episode's use of the character Onomatopoeia? Are you familiar with the character Onomatopoeia from Green Arrow?
No, I was not familiar with them. I looked them up. And, you know, it was kind of interesting. I think his visual design is incredibly strong.
Oh, that yeah.
Like, he looks like a really cool character. I wasn't quite sure how the whole assassin thing fit. They reminded me of like the characters from the Buffy episode, what do you call it? The gentleman in the Hush episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they all show up in town at the same time and they're trying to kill, who is it? We think they're trying to kill Commissioner Gordon, but they're actually trying to kill Barbara. I mean, it was okay. I would have liked a more intimate profile of this onomatopoeia. Why does he have like 10 goons, you know, if he's so cool? Like, I kind of would like to see more of a solo thing if he's going to be the villain. You don't need like the mooks and the jobbers.
Yeah, that's true. If he's this bad, you're right. I personally, okay, so I really like the character onomatopoeia. I read the issue where he was introduced, like literally buying it off the comic book stand, Green Arrow. It was the first floppy I'd bought in. I mean, honestly, it was the first DC Comics floppy I'd like ever bought. It was like that cover. I was like, I need this. And when I realized that's the character they were doing in this episode, I'm like, is that character even interesting in an animated show? Because like some things that are from comics work best as comics. And a character who speaks in onomatopoeia is and only in onomatopoeia and a printed comic book is doing something really interesting with how it represents sound. Because you can't actually represent sound on a flat comics page. It's not, there's actually nothing to listen to. And I'm like, so it's a cool sort of meta joke to have in a comic book. But in animation, where we do have sound, it's like, does this even mean anything anymore? I don't know. So I'm curious. It was interesting to hear for you who like were new to the character if you thought he was interesting.
Well, here's the thing. As soon as I looked him up, as his images from the comic, I was like, oh, he seems much cooler than in the animation. Exactly, because I couldn't, you know, say this, but you know, explain this, like the onomatopoeia in the print, it looks really interesting. It's like really cool. It has a really neat effect. In the show, it just reminded me of kind of a somewhat discordant reference to 60s Batman. Like, that's what I picked up from it. But when I'm actually looking at like these panels from the comics, they're like, they're really effective.
And he's very menacing in the comic. He's like a serial killer of like, he's a serial killer of heroes and stuff like that in the comic. And he's very fucking scary. So I understand the inclination for wanting to bring him in. And in general, I'm like very pro bringing in, you know, these smaller characters. But I just was like, I don't think he makes the leap from the page to the screen very well. And I don't think it's possible to make this character work on screen when he was built for the page. Speaking of, though, I can't believe Floyd Lawton is going down like a chump immediately. Like,
I know, right?
I was like, but Deadshot, he's got shot so fast.
And the real problem I had with this, and it was kind of like, again, an issue with the early episodes and how they blocked their scenes and their action. It made no sense. The guy, a professional assassin just runs up on the court steps in the front of like 10 cops and tries to shoot, we think, James Gordon, and just gets easily gunned down. Like, there might be three frames of him in the show. Like, he gets wiped out so fast, which is strange. Like Deadshot is like a character, you know, you could have him be an assassin. It was a very strange to like just throw him to like in front of like a wall of cops who just are ready and willing to gun him down. Very strange choice. It's like they didn't really think of a way to get themselves from point C to point D in the story. So they just did the kind of most straightforward thing.
I mean, what's so funny is that, like, part of the whole joke with Deadshot is he's, like, kind of passively suicidal. But I'm like, well, he's not that kind of passively suicidal. He's not, like, go shoot the cops in front of the other cops suicidal. He's a different suicidal. However, I did really enjoy these adaptation of all the young orphan Moppets. Carrie from...
I loved Carrie.
Oh, my God. I love her. She's, like, the one kid who's like, what if I kick this girl in the groin while she's trying to steal... And that she knows something is wrong. Like, she's just so much savvier than the other kids. She really is a hero.
Yeah, I really liked Carrie Kelly. I liked her presentation. But I did have a question. So, and it's worth talking about with this show. I don't think we talked about it enough. The supernatural and this show and the way it mixes it, because it tries to be, in a lot of ways, more grounded than a lot of Batman stuff, but also there is like Clayface in the second episode, and there's an episode with a ghost.
But Clayface is like definitely presented as super science. But yes, then there is literally
super
a ghost.
Science. Yes, there's literally a ghost, and then Nocturne is the episode with
suddenly,
the kids in it. There is a vampire. But she's an energy vampire, so she doesn't have fangs. You're not getting the blood. And I felt like I would have rather just a vampire. If you're going to have a vampire, have a vampire. You know, you already had a ghost, for God's sakes.
I mean, I thought she was kind of a cool twist on the notion.
Oh, she was. It was definitely a cool twist, but it's just my personal bias. I will always take a real legitimate blood-drinking vampire over anything else.
When we first had Jenna Lungo show up, and I'd enjoyed that episode a lot. I was like, wow, is the show really going to have an actual supernatural thing? And I was surprised when they did. But once they did, that opened it up to having, you know, whatever other kind of supernatural elements they might see fit. So, but it's true. I really wasn't sure if the show was going to have anything truly supernatural or not.
Yeah, because first of all, the ghost looks like a Scooby-Doo-ass ghost. Mm-hmm. So you were just waiting for Batman to rip the mask off, I think, until he teleports into the train.
Yes.
And so, like, you know, I did like that Batman's reaction was basically, well, I guess I got to figure this ghost shit out, too. Like, he is willing to accept that ghosts exist. And then he's like, all right, so how do I kill a ghost? That's like as deeply as he thinks about it. And I kind of like that. If you're going to bring in the supernatural, that has to be Batman's attitude at the very least.
And I like that it's, you know, Arthur is like the one who's being like, no, this is real. And that really was one of the early episodes to like show the sort of gap in their relationship. And I think in some of those ways, I thought that the creepy stuff was creepy. Oh, but my favorite moment in some ways from the from Nocturne, from the very supernatural episode, that one was when, you know, Batman is straight up when like he's trying to find Stephanie, young Stephanie Brown, who's like run off and getting Angie vampired away. And he like just busts through the wall to try to find her because like that is what you would do if there's a child who's screaming in panic. Is you never mind the property damage, you're going to go save the kid. But the other people don't know that that's happening.
Oh, yeah.
So he busts through the wall looking for the little girl, tries to explain himself. He's like, I'm helping. And the carnies are like, you don't look like you're helping. And the carnies are right. Like from their viewpoint, there's just a rich asshole who showed up and broke some of their very expensive equipment. So they beat his ass and dump him by the river, including clearly Killer Croc. And I love that. I love that because the thing is like, it's like, you know, the carnies are wrong, but based on the information they have, they're not wrong. And I appreciated that.
It's like it's a scene like lifted directly from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where Dennis is like trying to, I forget what he's trying to do, but he ends up at a park looking at children for some poorly explained reason, and he gets his ass kicked. And the same thing happens to Batman here. He's like, I'm looking for a little girl. What do you mean you're looking for little girls? Get his ass. It's funny.
Yeah. It's and, you know, but that's also an episode where you really see like Bruce is trying to solve problems through violence in some places, but he ends up not, that actually ends up not being successful. Like it's only like the emotion, addressing her emotional needs and telling her about what she did to her brother. Like that is what actually brings it down and makes it end. Which I thought was interesting.
What did you think about Papa Midnight's little cameo? Ooh. Which we don't call him Papa anymore. No. Apparently, that may be seem a little bit too racially insensitive. What was his Irving Midnight, something like that?
Well, I mean, I guess it's sort of like, what are you basing it? Like, which mythology is it drawing from? You know what I mean? But yeah, I enjoyed his moment. And when the guy's like, oh God, don't get me to him. And he's like, you don't want to know what I'm going to do.
Yes. I did dig it, but we didn't get to see his club with all the like demons and shit hanging out. We should have seen, you know, Demon and Constantine. There should have been a little bit of that. Like, if you're going to say, all right, ghosts exist and I need to talk to Papa Midnight to capture him, then show me all the ghosts in Gotham, all the demons.
Oh, that's too much for one's theories. I just think it's good for it to be beginning there. Maybe he hasn't even founded the club yet. Like, this is early for everybody, right?
Oh. Possibly. I don't know. How long has Papa Midnight been around? I feel like...
I don't know. It's a question. He might be long time standing, but I'm actually not sure.
18th century, apparently, he was born. He looks good. I mean, he looks good.
Yeah, I thought it was a cool... And I like that it was Alfred who's like, oh, I know a guy.
Yes.
Because Bruce, like, does not know a guy like that. But Alfred's like, I know a guy. I felt like I appreciated the implication of the fact that like Bruce does not know a guy for like I saw a ghost, but Alfred is like, I know a guy for when you see a ghost.
Yeah, and that's another thing. Like we could have had more scenes of Alfred being useful and then Bruce like dismissing him and disrespecting him.
I think that's true throughout the series though. He's the person who's like, Bruce, it's totally your fault that Harvey lost his shit, which is completely true. And Bruce is like, no, it's not. I mean, I meant more like
action stuff, like Alfred, like actually going out and like advancing the case, this or that case.
But that's because they're not ready for it yet. Like with the end of the season, you have Batman admitting that there's the four of them against the world in a way. And the four of them is him, the commissioner, Barbara, and Alfred. So like he's finally seeing that he's not actually doing everything alone. I think you're going to really like season two because I think everything that you're frustrated with the season one is stuff that's going to be, I think it's on purpose. I mean, obviously like having less animation is not on purpose, but I think that like the character frustrations of like, why is Bruce being like that? I think it's all because this is like where he's at in his phase of development and coming into himself is like, that's why he's like this still.
Yeah, I wish there were more moments of like where that directly conflicted in the story. Like every episode, I want to see like some blow up where Bruce is having trouble maintaining, you know, his Batman-ness, his relationship, because he's doing such a poor job. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see a little bit more. I just want to see more Batman because I really do think this is an interesting take on Batman and a dark take. But I think we could have seen a bit more of him. Throughout.
So what did you think of Harvey Dent in this series as well as his storyline?
Okay, so this is the character that I really felt like I've seen this story a lot of times, and this might be the least compelling one because he starts off as a piece of shit already. Like, from the beginning, he's, like, completely phony. It's not just people are saying, oh, Harvey Dent is such a phony. He's like, no, he is a phony. He just wants to be mayor. So when his downfall, like he is corrupt. So he has two downfalls. He takes Thorne's money. So that's one big downfall, but you don't really feel it because he was already, like, corrupt. You know, it's like he is like a sleazebag from the beginning. He's like someone who would work for Weyland Yutani. He's like a Beto O'Rourke type. He's not, and also you don't see, which you get immediately in Batman the Animated Series, I watched the show again, you don't see that he was already fucked up before the acid got poured in his face. And that may sound like a little bit of a contradiction, but he had these, you know, deep emotional issues, this anger issues.
Yes.
But he still was more or less like an upstanding person in the original series. And that conflict, when that is brought out in Two-Face, that's the Two-Face story. That's how that that works. In this, he's just like kind of a run-of-the-mill sleazebag who gets his face messed up, and then he turns dark and gets revenge and suddenly has these mental health issues that he did not express, you know, earlier in any real way. I liked the, who is the actor that does the voice?
Diedrich Bader.
It's an interesting character. It's not necessarily a bad character. Like, even that character minus the Two-Face stuff, like, you could have like a sleazeball ADA there, but I don't really know how you turn that into an effective, you know, Two-Face story, because you kind of have to have some part that feels sorry for Harvey. And it's so funny because when he's on the run, right, you have Barbara and Bruce and Gordon all talking about him. And every time they say something about him, they have to preface it with, Harvey was always pretty much a piece of shit, but we still should try to give him another chance. It's not the over the top, I actually think, speeches that you have in the Dark Knight film, where it's like, Harvey is just, you know, he was the best Gothamite that ever lived, and now it's so sad that he's fallen. It's much more of this pathetic guy who kind of always sucked, now is going through it for real, and now we have to stop him. And it just doesn't hit you quite the same way, because you don't really get that any of the characters really like or respect Harvey that much. Even Bruce. So it's like, so if none of these people care, why do I care?
Yeah, I felt that having Harvey start off being terrible was misguided. I thought that the performance was very good.
Yes.
And I really did enjoy his final episodes where he's fully cracking up. And the reason is because that is when you begin to see him express remorse. And one of the things that I enjoyed was realizing that they were having the scarred part of his face represent the side of him that was remorseful and upset. And it's the unscarred part of his face that was like talking about how everybody had it coming to them and everybody's bad and evil. And I appreciated that being, and I'm sure that this isn't the only, you know, Two-Face that kind of broke down that way. But it's a good choice to have done that. And I think that the scenes of him talking to himself when he's like first has his sort of mental breakdown after the restaurant scene, I thought that that kind of talking to yourself can be very hard to handle in a way that we take it seriously. I thought that the animation choices that were, they were playing around with him talking to his reflection and his reflection fragmenting off of the parts of the different parts of the glass of the building when he was having this debate with himself, and then Diedrich Bader's performance of those voices, that really came together in a very compelling way for me there. So I don't like the fact that he was shitty from the start, but I do like how they handled him in that crisis. And it's so easy to have a character talking to themselves, have it just come off as funny, and it actually did come up as upsetting. and it is in his rampage, in his terms of enrampagement, as they would have said on the Archer show.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, in those last two episodes, like, the character starts to come together. If anything, we just needed to see more scenes like that earlier on.
But I do wonder why they thought they had to have Harvey be a piece of shit from the start, is the thing.
Yeah.
Because the only thing is, like, what is this guy's desire in running for mayor? It seems to just be that he wants to be loved and appreciated. Like, that's the only motivation that we really see him having, because if he was really running because he wanted reform, then he wouldn't have been crooked in the first place. So he just wants love. He wants attention. We get the sense that he was like another privileged kid like Bruce. But then when you see his apartment, this is interesting. And maybe this is because he spent all his money in the campaign or something. But his apartment is like normal, right? So I was like, right. So he could have been like, either they could have been having him in this really like destitute living situation that was reflecting on him having spent all of his money, you know, trying to run this race, or had him be like in a dilapidated version of, you know, his former life of luxury. Because again, like, I think the show does make it pretty clear he was a rich kid with Bruce. But instead, it's just like, it's a very dirty, normal apartment, which was like, huh, none of the above. Okay. I don't know. I don't know if they just weren't thinking out the setting as a part of his character in that way, or having it just be dirty was enough for them. But I did like the way they introduced the flippancy of the coin tosses into the character.
And yes, that worked.
Right? Like, that worked, yeah.
Yeah, I dug it. I dug certain elements of it, but I wish, like, again, the choice to make him a piece of shit immediately just kind of, it messes with the arc. And like you said, having him talk out, the scarred face be the remorseful half, that's interesting. I like that. I find it. But the path to get there could have been a little bit better.
You know what I'm thinking? Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I think they might have had him be an asshole from the start because they wanted someone to have Barbara Gordon spar with. I think that might be why they had him set up that way from the start.
I can see that.
Right? Like, we see them first in conflict with each other in the court. So he really is Barbara Gordon's villain before he's Batman's, right? And yes. I bet that's why they did it. I don't know that it was the right choice, but I think that's probably why they did it that way.
Yeah, and speaking of choices, I hope I'm not taking over here.
Please.
I want to talk about the first episode and our new penguin.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we haven't really talked about her.
Okay, so this is one of the things that kind of turned me off early on. I think it turned a lot of people off. It's like they gender swapped the character of Penguin. And that's fine. That's cool. But the character that we got felt a lot less interesting than the other Penguin. And she doesn't really do much. And like, she has this kind of ridiculous plan to blow up the police.
That's normal for Penguin. When isn't Penguin doing some ridiculous plan? That's like classic Penguin.
For me, it felt a little bit discordant because the show tries to be in a lot of ways really more grounded. Mm-hmm. But then in the first episode, you have the Penguin shooting missiles at the police station, which is like Adam West levels of silly. It kind of took me a while to get into it. And by the end of the episode, she's like dead. I'm like, wait a minute, who's going to be like the person who helps transition us from the supervillains to the mafia? I felt like there's not one pure mafia episode in this whole series, which I would find very strange with the promotion of it. I hope we get to see more. I hope we get to see more organized crime, but maybe they're saving that for the movies and the Penguin TV show.
Well, I mean, Rupert Thorne is, like, as far as Batman is concerned, the big bad through the series. And he's really just trying to focus on Thorne the whole time. And it's all these costumed weirdos that keep getting in his way.
Yeah. I guess what I meant more is, like, one of the things I liked about Batman the Animated Series is that there were some episodes that were just, like, mob stories. Like, just
right,
none of the stuff. And there's not just one of those there. I expect to see at least one. Obviously, there is mafia stuff, but I was just surprised not to see one of those pure mob episodes because they always felt different.
Oh, my favorite little Rupert Thorne note was when they have that scene with Thorne watching TV watching baseball with his son, and you're kind of like,
yes,
oh, father-son moment. And then he's like, leave us alone. We've got money riding on this game. I'm like, oh, I love how like even their like nice little family moment is like not actually wholesome. There's like they're gambling.
He kind of reminded me of like Costco Dad. You know those guys?
No.
They're on TikTok. He's like, he's this big galoof and he takes around his kind of, you know, smaller galoof son around Costco. It felt like that sort of relationship. It was touching, but you know, they're both probably terrible people.
Got it. Well, okay. But back to the penguin thing. I have never found Penguin's not one of my favorite characters. So I don't dislike Penguin. I just don't really have feelings about Penguin one way or the other. So having Penguin get reinvented as like a woman with a cabaret gambling boat, I'm like, sure, why not? I wasn't like, I needed this in my life, but I also wasn't like, what are you doing? Like, it didn't really bother me. The way that things handled Penguin before, now either he's this like terribly tragic case or he's just a short, round guy who has like a bird fetish. And neither of those things feel like particularly like vital. But you're right that Penguin in general is a character who does a good job of bridging the costumed silliness and the mafia storylines in the series. The continuity problem that bothered me from this, which is actually the only continuity problem that bothered me in the whole series, really, is that she blows up the police station. But the next episode, they're back in the police station. That's the only thing I was like, but she just blew up the police station, which I was like, wow, that's an escalation. Wow. Think about all the criminal files. I was like, you're going to build a whole season around the fact that nobody has any files because this is like pre-computers. Nobody has any files on all of the criminals or any of the cases because they blew up the police station. Wow. What's that going to mean for crime fighting in the series? We're just back in the police station anyway. Okay, maybe not. But I thought there were a few really great moments in the episode.
Oh, well, wait, but just to pause that, I feel like it's possible that episode was that. Is it possible that parts of the episode might not have meant to be the first episode? If that's, you know, sort of the case, or maybe somewhat out of sequence in some form or fashion.
But at no point in time are we not using the police station.
Yeah.
Like, she blew it up and then it wasn't blown up. I don't know. There are some really great character moments in that first episode, like Harvey Bullock leaving this poor woman he's arrested handcuffed to the desk when everybody goes to evacuate. Like,
yes.
Yeah, that's a good tell. I liked that her son was like, no, I'm serious. She like really is going to fire a giant umbrella cannon at the police station. And then, yeah, it fucking happens. Oh, but what's funny is when Batman is in his little submarine to get underneath, you see that she's been dropping people's bodies in treasure chests in the ocean, like all around the gambling boat this whole time.
Oh, I missed that part, I think.
I missed it the first time, too. I only saw it the second time. I was like, oh, there sure are a lot of those. Oh, yeah, like how she put her son in there. How dark is it that she kills the wrong son and she's not even upset about it? I mean,
oof, yeah, that was pretty extreme. When I saw that, I was like, okay, this show is kind of going for it. But then by the end, it's like umbrella cannon. And I was like, okay, well.
It's a bit of a pivot from the umbrella cat to the umbrella cannon from the killing the wrong son and just being like, eh, what you going to do? My son suck anyway.
I do think that kind of gets to, like, to quote Ian Curtis, to paraphrase Ian Curtis, I feel like the show had the spirit, but a lot of times it lost the feeling. I didn't feel as much as I should have with that son dying because it was kind of like the plot needs to just keep going and going and going. When, again, that could have been a storyline told over a few episodes. You know, show us what her relationship is with her son before she kills one of them, you know?
Right, right. So, I mean, what you were saying is you've been waiting for a guide to come and take you by the hand?
Yes.
Sorry, we're just going to quote Joy Division at each other now.
Yeah, she lost control again and killed
the
other son.
She did lose control again. That's very funny. Actually, we should talk about, did the score register to you at all? I really liked the theme song.
It didn't register so much, but that's, for a Batman, that's like a high compliment. Like, it wasn't bad. It was fine. You know, there wasn't any pieces that I wanted to seek out and listen to, but like, it was adequate for a Batman show, which is a high compliment. That's like already like a 9 out of 10 right there.
Yeah, because the original Batman the Animated Series has them just truly an amazing score. Not just the theme music, but the score throughout the animated series is just amazing. And I don't think this gets close, but it's like good. It's good. The theme song is good and the score overall is good. You know, the Batman movie, which I ended up not covering on the show. I watched it late. And when I watched it, I liked it, but I didn't like it enough to go and do an episode so much after the time in which anybody else gave a fuck about it. You know, but one of the complaints we had about it was like how bad the movie score was. I came this close to just having my brother on because my brother works in the music industry, does composition, and he's an audio engineer and all that. And he was like, this soundtrack is two notes and it's so bad and I will just show you. And he like proceeded to like play me a scene and then play the note. He's like, this is what they're doing. And I was like, what? He's like, and not only is that, he's like, this is the score that they use for this other thing, but he's only using half the song. I was like, what? Anyway, someday I'll have my brother do a breakdown for why the score was so bad.
For almost 3 hours.
I was like, wow, it is terrible. It's a good point, David. Thank you. I did enjoy the movie in general, but he's right. The score is fucking terrible. And I didn't love it. I just was like, this was good, you know. But in many ways, this movie, this series is contiguous with that in the sense that Bruce from that movie was just as emotionally like not going to be capable of flirting with a woman, right?
Yes.
as the Bruce we have here. Like, it feels like it is tied with that in some way.
Yeah, I didn't like the Batman movie, but I did think that like at least we got those like brooding scenes with him where the bad soundtrack plays. At least that told us something about his mindset. I think do we ever see Batman by himself unless he's just like about to do like go on a stakeout or something? Like I feel like we saw so many scenes of Batman and other characters by themselves, talking to themselves, reflecting with themselves. I feel like we don't quite get that. And even when he was talking to Alfred in the original show, he was talking to himself and reflecting on his real feelings, but he doesn't have that kind of relationship with this Alfred. So we, like I said, I want to know how fucked up this guy is. Like, I really feel like they could get dark, and I'm a little disappointed now because I think the second season, it will certainly be better, but Batman will be a better person. He'll be over kind of all these issues without them playing out on the screen in a way that I would like to see more of. Like in the, like when he gets mad at Harvey at the end and he breaks, like I want to see more of that throughout the series. Cause even like the Nolan films had a lot of that. He liked to play with the tension between when Bruce has to like become Batman, like when he doesn't expect it. Like I would have liked to see a little bit more of that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. I'm just also just sort of thinking a little bit more just about a couple of interesting moments from the series, sort of political analysis and situation. But like when Dent is like losing his shit and going after people and he's like about to kill Tony Zito, who in the original comics, like Tony Zito is the guy who kills Dick's parents. But anyway, he's like, you aren't people, you're cancer. And personhood? What are people owed? And what do people belong? Like, these are really, like, the themes, I think, of the series. After Harley Quinn dies, or doesn't really die, but drops off a cliff and appears to die, you know, Bruce goes, like, is about to, like, lecture Babs. You know, he says, your friendship with Dr. Quinn made you reckless. And she's like, shut up.
Yes.
And he's like, yeah, you know what? You're right. Like, he realizes she's right. He's like, I have to go. And like her telling him to shut up actually like got through to him, which is like amazing actually. But like he, you know, it's sort of showing him being like, yeah, like when you have feelings for other people. And I feel like he's still someone who doesn't really see himself as a person. I mean, he didn't see Alfred as a person. I think the scariest thing that happened in this series is the flashback where you see like 8-year-old Bruce wake up Alfred in the middle of the night to tell him that he's going to make them pay. He's like, I'm going to make them pay and you're going to help me. And then like walks off. Like that's fucking bone chilling. And that's little baby Bruce. You know?
Yeah. I would have liked to see like even just one whole flashback episode. It was strange because people complain a lot about how every Batman piece of media has to show the killing of the parents. Mm-hmm. And this one doesn't. And it made it clear like why people lean on that a lot, because you do need to see Like, what turned this guy?
We do see it, though. We don't see the guy, but we do see it. We see it from Bruce's perspective.
Yes, but what I mean is, like, you do need to have, like, a little bit of background. And what I would like to see is more of his training, more of his growing up. Because I think his training would be a lot different than the traditional one that we see in Batman, where he goes overseas, meets Lady Shiva or the League of Assassins, what have you. I think he did a lot of different stuff. I think this is a guy, like you said, he's going to make him pay from when he's 8 years old. Was he pulling shit when he was that young? Like, was he trying to, was he a vigilante in prep school? Like, I kind of want to see, like, how this Bruce, you know, because he wouldn't have been able to present himself to present himself as this affable playboy when he's young, right? When he's a teenager, there probably would have been incidents and a point where he had to learn to control that and put on this persona. Like, I feel like that journey with this Batman would be interesting to see. Maybe they'll do it in the next season.
You're right. I think that's a good point. I think a young Bruce would not have even figured out how to do that yet. And yeah, so what would he have done? What do you think of the expansion and work with Bullock and Fless? Because as we said, like, yeah, Bullock usually isn't this evil. Fless is basically a new character. How did you feel about those characters together?
Like, again, like, I feel like those two characters work, but it would have felt like a bigger show if you had those two dirty cops and also Flask, the original Flask, who is a blonde white guy, and the original Bullock. You know, the station could, that was one thing I wish, the station could have been a little bit bigger. I think maybe we only get like five named cops.
Yeah, and like, you know, what, Corrigan goes and tries to shoot Babs. Like, we get, like, yeah, it's like very, I think they just didn't have much time to expand on it. But like, I like Harvey Bullock, who's truly contemptible, like, because that just feels more real to me.
Oh,
and obviously, John DiMaggio is, like, you know, one of the best fucking voice actors in the world. He does a great bit when he shows up as that film producer in episode two as well. But
yeah, obviously, you know, ACAB in real life. But I like a Bullock who has a little bit of redeeming quality to it as far as a TV character goes. Nothing like in real life, just as a TV character. But like, yes, having it. But the problem does become then, of course, that Renee Montoya now, in contrast, is like completely like squeaky clean, incorruptible. Yeah. Like, so it's like, it has this critique of the police, but then, and Gordon too. Gordon and Renee Montoya, they're like more like by the books than they are in most other representations. So you have the dirty cops are dirtier, but the good cops are gooder at the same time. And that is actually feels like a lot less realistic to me. Like, if you're going to do noir, that means all the systems have to be polluted. All the participants have to be corrupted. All of them. Barbara should be corrupted past just being friends with Harley Quinn. Gordon needs to be corrupted past just being stubborn and a little bit useless. You know, there should be more compromises, that this sort of compromises that Harvey Dent made, we should have seen some of the other characters make and have to contend with that and let that be a conflict that they have with Batman. I would like to see a Batman who's kind of judgmental of all these characters. Is not just that he's distant from them, he has this, you know, much more black and white philosophy that does not work for a real district attorney or a real defense attorney, like, or a real police commissioner. Like, that could have been, I mean, obviously it's implicit since Gordon keeps these corrupt cops around and, you know, Dent works with them, et cetera, et cetera. But it could have been more explicit, I think. Like, if it's going to be noir, let it be noir. Let everybody be a little bit corruptible. And then the story is how, you know, Batman, this, you know, completely, you know, deranged figure somehow shows them the path and, you know, elevates them and they become better people as well and less corrupted and more idealistic because Batman is because he's broken, but his brokenness fixes them. Something like that, you know.
Well, I think that the way they represent, I mean, the corruption of Gordon, of Jim Gordon, is that he's hasn't gone after the corruption in the department because he doesn't think he can win, and he just was trying to hold on to his job.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I wish it was just
desperate for his own survival, you know?
Yeah, it's implicit, but I wish it was just a little bit more like just on the screen, just a little bit more like discussions about that. Or like even Batman saying, why you keep these people around, Jim, if you're such a good cop, you know, something like
that. I think, and I might be wrong, that his daughter does sort of say, like, give him shit for not having gotten rid of those guys. But, like, you know, but the mayor is so shitty. It's like he's just trying to, you know, I don't know. I mean,
you know, the mayor is like super corrupt. They do establish that the mayor like works with the mobster, and and Thorne is trying to play both sides of the mayoral race.
Yeah, yeah. No, that actually, one of my moments where I was like, that's not how this works, kids, was like when they were like, oh, the two unions have like resented their endorsement. And I'm like, wait, are you saying that two of the unions endorsed a challenger to the incumbent mayor? Like, have none of you read a newspaper? Like, I say this as somebody who predominantly works for labor unions. Like, please don't shoot me. But I'm just like, there's very legitimate reasons why they operate this way. But I'm just like, you could have made up, I don't know, some believable organization that would have like, to like have gone for the, you know, the challenger against an incumbent. Like, come on. Yeah, but that's so what you get when you have people who aren't just writing TV shows with political plot lines, is you have people who haven't like thought about how politics actually operate much. Having Harvey run from the DA's office itself, like there are so many different kinds of challenges. Like he's not on the campaign trail nearly enough like to actually have been looking like a viable candidate. And maybe this is something I should take as it being part of a period piece. I don't know.
No, so I actually want to talk about this, the fact that it's a period piece, right? Because I feel like in a lot of ways, it's kind of hampered by that. And I am not talking about the design elements at all, because I think Batman the Animated Series, you could look at it as taking place in modern day. It's just that Gothamites are all hipsters, you know, because there is like some form of like there's modern technology at times and a lot of modern concepts. Like Batman has a big ass computer. Yeah. And I actually think that this show kind of regresses that. Like, no, it's literally like in the 50s, you know, and that presents kind of two problems for me. One, it can't have like a lot of commentary on like modern stuff, or like like social media and Harvey Dent would have been an interesting thing to explore. Yeah. Social media and Catwoman would have been an interesting thing to explore. And the other issue, I mean,
they definitely talk about how she exists in media, like the whole thing with E.L. O'Brien, aka Plastic Man, but like as a newspaper photographer who you can pay off to take stuff for you. And like how they use him and the press to tell her story and then to tell Batman's story. And I mean, so they are thinking about how media is used, but you're right. Like there's definitely certain storylines they can't really go through. But I do kind of appreciate the remove a little bit, though. I mean, it's still talking about the themes that we deal with. It just doesn't have to have, I don't have to sit through them trying to draw like a painful equivalent that might not exist.
Yeah. One other issue with, you know, the time frame being so like hard instead of soft and ephemeral, is that when it comes to the race of the characters and the sexuality of the characters, the show really doesn't address the fact that, oh, a major city with a black police commissioner, that would be like an issue, right? Like in the 1950s when this takes place, you know.
I'd say 40s.
Yeah. 40s maybe. Or, you know, two women openly kissing at a restaurant would probably be an issue.
But that's why they have it be fictional. It's not trying to be. Because like it would be a very different. The entire series would be about, oh my God, Gotham has a black commissioner. Like that would be like if they were going to treat it like a realistic depiction of the time
period. But that's the thing. I would actually like to see some of that. I would like to see the show talk about race. I can understand like not doing it, but it makes the fact that the show otherwise does not address racism, sexism, gender discrimination. It kind of makes it stand out a little bit more that that commentary is missing, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't necessarily, like, and if it wasn't such a hard time limit, that conflict wouldn't be so at the forefront of my mind, is what I'm saying.
I guess just for me, it was like, I don't trust that the show would do a competent job at
yes.
those topics. And like, especially given the sort of space and time for it. So I would rather them not try to like teach me a lesson about America's history, something that I probably know more about than they do, than like, you know what I mean? Like, you're right. Like, it creates a situation where the show is less ambitious, but I also don't really have faith in its ability to, if it was taking on those ambitions, I don't know that I have faith in it achieving something that wouldn't have felt simplistic or stupid, or
I agree with you, except for one small caveat. When you look at Batman the Animated Series, mm-hmm. now they don't talk explicitly about race that much, but there are implicit scenes. Like, there's certain characters who feel like they're black for a reason, right? So I feel like in certain ways you could do stuff like that. I could trust them to do stuff like that, but they don't. It kind of just does not exist as a factor, similar to like in the MCU movies. Like, race doesn't really exist in any way. It's not really addressed. So a lesson episode, you know, like a Damon Lindelof's Watchmen thing. My God, this show is produced by J.J. Abrams. We should not be giving them any ideas about doing anything like this. But it could have had a little bit more something to it, like, especially when you compare it to something like X-Men 97, which is kind of really loud about some of this stuff. Like you said, it just makes the show feel a little bit less ambitious.
Yeah, but it's true, though. It's a good point. The X-Men 97, which, you know, you and I are going to talk about soon, is a show that like is similarly limited in its ability, in its time period, is in fact aimed at a younger age group and still really fucking goes there about politics. That's true. But we also were talking about that show, like, that's the best thing ever, because, like, we just never thought a show would be able to, like, tackle those things. But you're right. X-Men 97 shows what, like, could be possible, even though I just was like, I will tell you, like, when I saw they were, like, you know, they were going to have, like, a more diverse representation of people in the series, I was like, I really don't want them to try to lecture me about this, because I don't think, I don't trust that they're going to say, tell me, you know, as a queer person, like, anything that I want to have them say to me. You know, and I think there is something fun about just being like, yes, we exist in this world and in this space in history, even if, like, it wasn't actually how people would want to, you know, would have played out. Like, I don't know.
Like, you could even do fun stuff. Like, at no point does Barbara call Bruce a white boy. I mean, you could at least do that.
I'm curious what the diversity of the writer's room was or wasn't, I think, is a legit question.
Oh, I do want to address, at certain point, Batman takes a murder weapon that has just been used to murder someone and he throws it into the sea. And that just seems like very bad chain of custody practice from a Batman.
Yes.
It was dramatic, though. It did look dramatic. It looked cool as hell, but
you sort of see him pondering the gun and then being like, no, fuck this. You know, I think that was, but we know that that's the choice Batman will make, you know, but it is something like they really were like, no, we want you to see this again, especially because, again, like, we're looking at this, the dark version of Bruce, who's Dent, who's going around shooting criminals and stuff, you know?
Yeah, I could definitely believe this Batman would straight up shoot a guy. And I think that's a pretty good scenario to set up. Like, there was no, like, in the, I think, when does he use the gun in the original animated series? Is it in Batman Beyond? I know in his last mission in that in that timeline, he picks up a gun because he's like too slow or something. He's getting old and he almost, you know, eats it, and he has to pick up a gun to defend himself, and he's disgusted by himself and he hates himself for it. So that was a pretty evocative moment for it. But this Batman, I just straight up feels like he would just probably shoot a guy if he got mad enough about it.
So I think it's why then, if that's true, then I think that's why it's good that they showed him tossing the gun and making the commitment to be like, actually, no. And I think it's his disgust at Flesh that makes him make that decision.
But then, like, he's going to get off. He's going to get off. There's no evidence. There's no murder weapon. Just the only... I thought that was... I really wish that they had mentioned that. That would have been a really funny moment, I think. And, you know, you can have a little... there was some funny moments in this show. There was a decent amount of humor that I thought was liked, which I liked in the original series as well.
Well, I want to thank Leslie again for joining me. I just got to talk with him on Struggle Session, actually, about X-Men 97. So folks should go and listen to me there as well. And for sure, listen and subscribe to Struggle Sessions. And as for me, signing off from Graphic Policy Radio / Election Volunteer Central. You know, I'm volunteering with grassroots groups turning out voters of color. But as I said, feel free to drop in, ask questions, and as we like to say at Graphic Policy, keep it geeky.